Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Earl Jesse, a unique personal story. His journey from being sexually abused as a child and then into the world of drug dealing, crime and violence, and how he was saved when the police finally arrested him. Also, Alan Brown. He's a Bristol-based economist and he talks about Labour's conundrum, the problem being that the Labour target seats voted Leave. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, the Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen and paper ready at the end of the show. This programme includes a candid look at the way pornography can be used to groom children for sexual abuse. It is not suitable for all audiences. So please, if you have someone of a nervous disposition or children around, switch off now.
My name is Earl Jesse. At the moment, I'm academically trained as an artist and I run my own sort of workshops and things, various things. But I teach in self-defence and martial arts as well and do personal training. East Garston, it's West Berkshire, so it's in between... I suppose there's a village called Lambourne, which is well known for the racehorses, the Valley of the Racehorses. Yeah. It's a lot of Arabs. And
was it a bit like cabin fever? You're out in the middle of nowhere. This is not ideal for most teenagers, is it?
Oh, when you're young.
Or even younger than that.
Yeah. I mean, when you're young, I think it's fantastic because you've got rivers, streams, trees to grow. You get on your bike. You can just cycle. You can run for miles. You live off the land. You go scrumping. You eat fruit from the trees. You go fishing. I mean, it's endless amounts of imagination to go through. In a town and a city, I think sometimes that confinement causes that sort of rebellion, that cabin fever. Whereas in the early years for me as a child, absolutely loved it. I was so in touch with nature and I crave that still now. So that's kind of come full circle for me. As I got older, yeah, there was more of a craving to be around people like my own age. Yeah. Because in a small village...
Well, you see, for a lot of teenagers, if they're not doing something in the evenings, they're not interacting with other kids their own age, they start crawling up the walls,
yes,
don't
they? Yes, definitely. I'll get to that. I'll get to things like petrol bombing and shooting police officers and stuff. We'll get to that later on. So he remarried, which was a very welcomed sort of situation, because all of a sudden the family of people of three suddenly become people of like 20. So we had all these new people, new faces, different age groups. There was all these new traditions coming in. My dad had one set tradition. Sunday was Sunday roast. That was the only traditional food, and Christmas and things. Birthdays were nothing. It was just literally those two things. You have Christmas and you have Sunday roast every Sunday. So this family moved into... a rather large set family, I would rather say. I think there were 6 siblings. Two of the siblings were twins, a boy and a girl. So I was sort of every Saturday we would go over there and they'd go out and do things. And on Sunday, they would always have like a Sunday roast. In the evening, they would always have cakes and trifles and things. So all this abundance of food was amazing.
So did you fit in? Did you still feel like you were a bit of an outsider?
I was like an outsider. I was the youngest, obviously the youngest, not obviously, but I was the youngest person within that group as well. My uncle Arthur was disabled, so he was just sort of put in a chair and fed and stuff, and he didn't mind that. So anyway, this all seemed to be going quite well. I suppose the first elements when my dad got married, his new wife, what you would call my stepmother, there was some psychological games going on. So that one of the ones that I remember was you had the kitchen cupboards, so you had the ones down the bottom with the kitchen sides, and then you had a cupboard up on the wall. And the cupboard up on the wall was quite clearly stated to me that was the family's cupboard, and I wasn't part of that family. And I was like, well, what family is this? And she announced she was pregnant, and she had another baby coming on the way, so that was going to be hers, her child, and my dad's. So that was a cupboard. That was always full of treats. That was full of all snacks, things you could easily eat for the daytime. You don't have to prepare anything. You just take it out, you know, put it onto bread and butter or whatever. But the bottom cupboard was all like flour and like, you know, bags of rice and stuff you had to cook. I was like 6 years old. So there was never any food in the house apart from those things. So my Uncle Arthur, who was disabled, and I were part of the other family. And she quite clearly stated that. I don't think my dad actually knows today that that was going on. This was kind of her sort of interaction with the two types of the family. So that continued for many years. There's a psychological, I would say, systematic starving. She used to purposely buy food, and food that I would never eat. I've never liked fish. I've never liked any type of fish. It always makes me gag. It literally makes me want to vomit, just the smell of it. So she'd purposely buy fish paste. She'd purposely buy fish and put it on the tables and stuff, knowing that I would never eat it. So I'd just sit there looking at it. And I was razor thin as a child anyway, so it wasn't like I needed to be eating less food. So these were kind of one of the sort of mind games and stuff. And she would say stuff to me like, oh, if you don't do this, you're going to go and live with your mum or your foster care. We're going to put you into adoption. So these were sneaky things she would say behind my father's back. So these were the sort of beginning of the sort of, I would say, emotional abuse.
You're saying something here about human nature, aren't we? That actually people have to work at being good. You know, they have to work at being nice. Maybe people aren't naturally wonderful. You know, anyway, so you found something like that out from your stepmum.
Yes, very young age. And while this was happening, because this went on for many years, while this was happening, her younger brother, who was one of the twins, kind of took me under his wing and sort of befriended me, which was quite nice. I had an older uncle. It was like pretty cool. Mm. It was almost like a friend, like an older friend, many years older than me. Little did I know that what was actually happening is he was grooming me. And that was the beginning part. So obviously, I can look back now and I can see the stages of the grooming.
So how old were you at that point?
About six, seven. I've done the police interviews and things, and I've been interviewed by a friend. We've got the videos and stuff. The actual memory of exactly when things happened, are quite blurry. I think primarily because of the trauma that happened.
So what did happen?
I was raped on multiple occasions. So I was raped by him. But he groomed me in a ways. I think the first way was the observation of watching porn. He would sneak videotapes into his bedroom upstairs.
So this is interesting. I mean, how did he actually do that? I think people need to know what are the initial warning signs that someone is starting to do this sort of thing?
If you can take it apart in many different cofactors. One of the ones, I wasn't really watched. I wasn't looked after as a child. I was always left to my own devices, so I was never really sort of monitored in any way. Like, I was a young child, so there should have been sort of every so often, where's Earl? You know, what's he up to? But it wasn't. There was never any sort of thing like that sort of thing happening. So that's another thing, sort of detachment of I suppose, parental responsibility for me. Then he would isolate me in certain ways. He said, oh, do you want to go upstairs and watch a film? And I'd be like, oh, yeah. So he'd put on like a cowboy and western or something or whatever it was, or put the TV on. And then he'd put on a porn DVD, a VHS tape or a Betamax. He'd obviously watch how I reacted. And obviously I'd watch it in a lot of confusion. I didn't really know what I was watching. But I was introduced to sex, hardcore porn sex, at a very young age. And he would show me magazines and stuff and watch. Now I know he was observing how I was interacting with it and how my body was reacting to it. So he was, in some way, I suppose, watching me get slowly turned on, or to find out how my brain was figuring out that's a girl.
Okay, so how long did that go on for?
I can't give you an exact date how long it went on for. I remember the initial stages. I can remember there were certain points of watching videotapes and reading magazines and stuff. The initial point was he used to babysit for two girls opposite where his mum lived. So he would be over there, and he must have been in his teens, mid-teens. And he would invite me to go over there. And they had Sky Satellite, which was quite new back then. So then, if you don't know if you ever watched Sky Satellite, it used to be like RTL channel and stuff. There used to be soft porn, which was like fake porn. So he used to watch that while the parents were out. So he would sit on the sofa, and one time, I remember the very first time, he confessed to me that he was gay. And I didn't really know what gay meant. I had an understanding that was...
Well, again, is it your six at this point? Or how
six, yeah, about yeah. six, seven, yeah. I remembered it was like two boys. People go, oh, you're gay because two boys would hold hands or something and they would laugh at two boys. So I kind of knew it meant two males, two boys or two men, but I didn't understand the interaction of what actually meant if you, you know, to have intercourse. So anyway, he told me he was gay and he explained what gay people do. And he asked me to take my trousers down, and he would show me what, you know, what gay men do.
So how long did this go on for?
The abuse. I can't give you a time scale.
A year? A month?
It longer. It happened between the ages of six and the ages of nine, because I know okay. it stopped. I know it stopped when I was nine. So
did you stop it, or how did it stop?
So the abuse itself, what was happening, when he was babysitting, sometimes when I wasn't there, what he used to do is watch the softcore porn channel. So he'd wipe it on the back of the cushions. And then what the parents of the parents that were hiring to look after his children, they found they must have smelt something, or they must have went to wash the cushion covers and saw this, and they were like looking at it, obviously being very suspect about what it was.
Yeah. So basically, someone discovered him. What about your father? What was his role in all of this?
My dad worked in racing. Well, he used to work in racing. He's a very small gentleman.
Horse racing.
Yes, he was a jockey. Yeah. He was a jockey, but he broke his neck in two places. So unfortunately, he couldn't continue riding the horses, so he became a head travelling lad.
So did you talk to your father about any of this? Was it all completely secret?
It was kept secret primarily. One, the guy that my abuser, the guy Johnny, he would threaten me, and he would say, "If you tell anyone, this is, you know." And he would make I suppose sort of things make certain gestures about what he would do and who he would say, and he'd say I was lying and stuff like that. And it's very difficult to remember exactly what he used to say, but I used to remember I was quite scared, but. So I just kept it myself, but I never had a...
So it was actually the people who were getting him to do the babysitting that discovered it, and what happened then?
So they obviously took the cushions to his mum and said, look, we found this. The only person that comes to our house that's on a regular basis is your son. So they called this massive meeting. Now, my dad wasn't there. I believe he was away with the horses, because he used to travel to France and Europe taking these like race horses abroad. So his wife was there, which was my stepmother. And they had this meeting, and she asked me in secret, what is it? And I said, okay, it's Johnny's. And she was like, right. So they asked me to leave the room. And then I'm guessing something happened. But after that very meeting, he stopped interfering with me.
So was there any hint of this being reported to the police at the time?
No, not at all. Not at all. I didn't say anything. It was kind of a weird relationship, because I believed he was my friend. I believed he was my good guardian. I believed he would protect me. And I was a very lonely child in that sense. I just spent a lot of time alone. So one of the things he would say was, I'm not going to be your friend anymore. Of course, being 6 or 7 years old, it doesn't sound like much, but when you're that age.
Speaking to me there, Earl Jesse. And now we hear about his entry into the world of drug dealing, crime and violence.
With my friend Tony, we started experimenting with cannabis and LSD. It kind of his friends were doing like amphetamine speed.
I mean, did you initially get hold of that sort of?
Well, he was. I said he was older than me, so he was already out working. So he would work doing fencing and stuff in Britain, and labouring. I left school at 15 because I was one of the youngest in my year. So I was doing college. So I was around people taking drugs all the time. I wasn't really, I drink, yes, definitely. I used to drink vodka until I collapsed. But so he was around people that were taking drugs and I was around people taking drugs. And there was a curiosity growing and we would talk about it. And they're idiots. Those people take drugs. They're silly, you know, just drinks the way forward. But drink would make us aggressive. And we'd go out and one of the local pubs.
I mean, at this point, surely you must have come to the attention of the police enough times too.
Oh, yeah. I've been arrested at 15, 16, but under the age of 18. So the police would literally, I mean, one time they had a like telephone book and they give me a hiding for a telephone book, so there's no bruises. So this is when I was a kid. I wasn't even 18 years old. But this is police back then, you know, and they would just let you go.
So this is 1980s,
yeah? This is, yeah, the 80s, yeah. So.
But no, you didn't go to court?
No, crikey. Even when I got done for shoplifting, they slapped me on the wrist and said, just get out of here, you idiot.
Okay, so the drugs, what happened?
So the drugs were sort of, things were sort of happening with the cannabis, smoking and stuff, and LSD sort of came into our scope, our radar. So we decided to experiment with stuff. We had no idea what we were doing. We were sort of asking people to sort of, what do we do, take this? And so we did the LSD for a while, opened our minds, made us a bit more peaceful, a bit more spiritual, I suppose. But we were always pushing, each other. If one did two, I had to do three. If he did three, I did four. There was a constant competitiveness of us. If someone did that, if you pushed him, I got to push her. There's always this constant, you know, and it's sort of rivalry, but like a brotherhood. And our other friend, Tom, he sort of broke off from the gang. He was like, this isn't, you guys are just pushing it too far. You're always taking it. And he could see where we were going, so he broke off. And so we stayed together. I
mean, was it easy to get hold of drugs in a little village?
yeah. It's, I mean, just because you're in a village, it doesn't mean that you're not connected to towns and stuff. And there's always people that go to towns and buy bulk. And they might not be drug dealers as such. They just buy a bulk for a little bit cheaper. They bring it back to their local little village and they have a couple of people they sell it to, and they make a couple of pound on what they sell. And sometimes what they purchase, they actually buy it for free because the profit they make actually covers what they bought it for. So you could call that a warehouseman or a drug dealer, whatever you want to. But they would, you know, there was always ways and means. So they, we experimented with LSD and cannabis for a while. And then we used to, through the weekdays, we'd go to a local pub called the Queen's Arms, just down the road. Very, very affluent pub. Lots of
was that in your village?
Yes, yeah. It was the only pub in the village. Anyway, there was a lot of trainers used to, the jockeys and trainers used to go. So on Fridays and Saturdays, it was full of affluent people with a lot of money. So we, on the weekdays, we would go down there, use the pool table and stuff. And there were three landlords that owned the pub. I'm not going to mention names because I'm guessing some people are around. But anyway, one of them used to chat to us, really nice guy. And we would go down there, have a couple of drinks and play pool and stuff. And anyway, I think it was one Thursday night, we'd had a couple of drinks. There was a group of about eight guys in the pub. And they were kicking off in the pub and making a bit of a racket and causing a little bit of issue with customers. The customers were leaving. Anyway, they said something to us while we were leaving. My friend Tony said, that's all right, let's go. I walked outside. He said, you got your knife on you? I said, yeah. He said, let's go by the tree. And outside there's a huge, great oak tree. And we knew their cars were parked next to it, so we just sat by the tree and waited for them to come out. And when they came out, Tony walked up and he had a lump of wood with him, like a part of a tree branch, and walked up and said, you got something to f***ing say to me? And they're going, what, you got something to f***ing say? And started smacking one guy around the head with a tree, with a branch. So I ran over with my knife, pulled my flick knife out and stuff. The guy's like, whoa, they're all running around the car park like rats running around. I said, come on then, trying to slice them up. And of course, these guys were literally like headless chickens running around trying to get into their cars. We were smacking them with the cars, kicking them and stuff. And the guy from the pub was watching all this, and he saw these two, no more than late teenagers, take on these eight guys in a pub car park, and literally they ran off, oh, we're going to come back and get you and stuff.
So were any of them seriously injured at that point then?
I don't know. They couldn't have been that injured because they came back the next week. They came back the following Friday. So what happened after that incident, we went back home. We just forgot about the weekend, did our usual sort of LSD stuff on the weekend and done our trips. And then on a Thursday evening, this guy, the landlord, had knocked on my dad's door and knocked on my friend Tony's door. He'd left a message with my dad and said that we should come to the pub. And Tony had spoken to Tony's mum and said he should come to the pub. We've got a present for us. And I'm thinking, so we obviously got tooled up. We thought it was our local. We haven't been there for a week. So we took like a little iron bar with us, extra knives and stuff, and went into the pub expecting to get a kick in, you know, and expecting it to be, you know, a proper kick in. But we thought, pride, ego, this is our village, this is our pub, you know, mentally. Anyway, went in there and the guy sort of said, come in, guys, give us some free pints of Cronenberg and stuff. And I'm thinking, he's going to get us drunk and then the guys are going to come in. It's like, you know, it's like the old gangster films, you know, it's like a soft touch. So we're about three pints in and Tony's going, don't drink anymore, don't drink anymore. He's probably spiked the beer. He's probably got vodka or something in it. He said, just don't drink anymore. And the guy, he said, have another pint. We go upstairs in my flat. And Tony's like, this is it. They're going to take us upstairs. They're going to jump us. They're going to jump us from behind. Tony was super paranoid. That's what kept him alive, I think. Anyway, we ended up going upstairs in this guy's flat and he had these little white lines of powder up on the kitchen side. And by this time, I had no dinner at all. I hadn't eaten since like probably 9 o'clock in the morning. So I'm completely empty, 4 pints of Kronenbourg in this skinny little belly of a body. And I'm swaying around in the bathroom thinking, am I going to be sick or do I need the toilet? And I'm sat with my hand on the rail on the ceiling trying to focus. Anyway, Tony thought it was speed. He thought it was amphetamine. Turns out this was proper grade A cocaine. And of course, when you've been drinking, you do cocaine, you sober up instantly. As seen in the film, the Denzel Washington film, where he's a pilot, an alcoholic. And there's a part in the film where they invite the drug dealer in, and he gets these two bags of coke.
Do you know what the film is?
There's one. It's about the airplane. He flips upside down. So people will know. So I was up in the flat and I was in between the point of either going to be sick or go to toilet. And I could hear my friend Tony sniffing, going, taking these things. And he's like, oh, and I thought, oh, what's he doing? And as I walked out, I managed to not throw up. And he passed me this £50 note. And I thought, oh, big, you know, £50 notes were massive back in the 80s. They were huge. And he passed me his note and said, he got some speed. And I was like, speed? I'm thinking speed. I thought, oh, okay. And I went over there and I just did these tiny little lines and sat there and I sort of leant against the kitchen counter and I was sort of like clearing my nose, thinking. And after a couple of minutes, all this, like, you know, this drunkenness, this dizziness, the sort of, you know, sort of your head spinning, just went. My chest pumped up, my shoulders went back, and I just thought, whew. I thought, I'm here. I thought, well, hang on a minute. I thought, well, what's just happened? And it was like that, like I said, in the film, Flight with Denzel Washington, there's a scene, because the pilot's an alcoholic, and he makes this maneuver where he turns the plane upside down, and he has to go to court, etc. Anyway, they put him in a hotel room the night before the court case, forgetting that he's an alcoholic. And of course, it's got a bar in the room.
Yeah, mini bar.
Yeah, mini bar. So he drinks all the alcohol. They go in the morning to pick him up, and he's splattered across the bed drunk, and they're like, right, what can we do? And someone says, get in some cocaine. And they go and get this dealer that comes in with these two massive bags of cocaine, going, this one's such and such and this one's really good. They go, just give us the really good stuff. They get him to snort these couple of lines of coke, and Denzel Washington's up like, right, we're off to the courtroom. They get him in a suit and he's walking fine, he's straying down the room. So it's just a sort of a snippet on what cocaine can do if someone's really drunk and sort of,
and know. Even if they are, or if they're not drunk, do you think sometimes politicians do that before they go into the House of Commons?
Oh, come on. I think thing like cocaine, certain people can take it without very little facial, very little effects that can be seen, especially if you're taking small amounts as well, tiny small amounts. If you go back to films like Scarface and that, these guys are sniffing it all the time in the film. Obviously, these are films, but the representations of real life. And if you're taking tiny little spoon, tiny little dips of cocaine, it doesn't really affect you. You know, if you take like loads of it, you get itchy, you're fidgety, your stuff, your eyes go massive and dilated. But you know, if you're wearing
cocaine, yeah. Yes. What about things like heroin, crack?
Oh, that comes later. That was that was our introduction to cocaine, and also an introduction to an opportunity to be minders or bouncers for this pub. So we were paid not in cash; we were paid in alcohol and cocaine to look after the pub and to keep the idiots out, even though we were complete idiots ourselves in that sense. But this landlord was like, look, I've got idiots that come in my pub. I've got people that spend hundreds, if not nearly thousands of pounds a weekend in my pub on bottles of champagne, treating their girls, their ladies, their wives. I don't want idiots in here pushing these customers away. So he would literally have us in the pub doing stuff and things. And it kind of word spread. And the pub's a very interesting place because a guy that used to come and work there and rented a flat at the back, we got friendly with, and this guy used to sell pot. It was a conversation in a pub over a game of pool. And, oh, do you want some pot? Yeah, I got some back at the flat, and we got introduced to this guy. And this guy called Carl, he was like, oh, yeah, you know, come back. And we were sort of mingling with him, and he basically adopted me. He saw something in me. He couldn't control my friend Tony, but he thought he could probably control me. Once again, an observation from the past, from myself looking at how things worked out. So he got me to start selling pot for him. It's cannabis, like solid. It was like what you call mirror press or soap bar. Soap bar is probably the easiest word. So people that know about nine bars in cannabis, and you get soap bars, you cut into ounces, you have ounces, and you cut down into eighths. So this guy
hash,
would, yeah, cannabis, yeah, solid lump. So a nine bar would be like a giant thick bar of chocolate, and it'd be like seal packed in like sellotape, or like seal packed in like some sort of like cellophane. And then what you would do, there's many ways to heat it up. You can microwave it, you could heat it on water and stuff, you'd wrap it up, stick it in the oven. But the ways, then you cut it with a sharp knife into ounces, and then from the ounces you cut it down into small blocks of eighths, and you could heat it and then burn it into your Rizzler and have it and smoke spliffs. So this was my first introduction to kind of drug dealing, or to sort of being shaped to sort of sell for someone, to work for someone. And that was kind of, this is the sort of big opening now. So we were sampling drugs, taking drugs, drinking alcohol, partying. And we started meeting more and more people through me selling cannabis. And then I was selling acid, and I was selling bits of coke and stuff. And then before you know it, you're kind of, you've got a reputation for yourself. And you don't really know it, but people phone you up. People are phoning you up all for the week. They phone you every day of the week. You got any pot? You got any pot? Drive down in vans and taxis and stuff. And my dad's, you got a lot of friends. People knocking on my door every couple of like 20 minutes, half an hour, especially on Friday nights and Thursday and Friday nights and Saturday nights. So I kind of sort of got into supplying, but from being supplied from this guy, this other guy, who as I found out, was quite big time. He had big connections up north.
So what actual drugs were you dealing? Just go through the whole list.
Anything from basically street drugs, so from LSD to microdots to cannabis to Miraprez, sometimes grass, amphetamine, speed, ecstasy, cocaine. One of the things I never sold when I was doing those things was heroin. I always refused to sell heroin. I always saw it as a dirty drug.
What about crack?
Nope, never sold crack or heroin at that time.
Earl Jesse there. And now we hear how Earl was saved, literally, he believes, when the police finally arrested him. So we skip several years on, by which time he was using and dealing crack and heroin.
I was with my girlfriend at the time. She was driving around, and she would just drive around. I'd just say, you go here, go there, drop me here, go drop me here. I'd walk off, come back to the car, drop me there. So she knew what I was doing, but she didn't know how much, what was being spent, what was being sold. And there's a part in Lambourne where there's a little triangle by the Catholic Club, and there was about 13 police cars. There was senators, there was riot vans, and they just basically, as we drove around this corner, I could see the police cars behind. She was like, and she started panicking. I said, just go this way. And as we come to this triangle, there was police cars everywhere. They already knew where we were.
This is Wiltshire.
This is Berkshire. Berkshire. I think police, it was a mixture of both, actually, to be fair. It may have been Oxfordshire. Oh, yeah, I got taken to Oxfordshire, actually. So there must have been Oxfordshire police too. I wasn't taken to West
Thames Valley.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure. So, the police... At the time, they'd already raided my dad's house, so I wasn't there. I didn't know this when I was being arrested at the time. They arrested my then girlfriend, and they'd made numerous arrests across the whole of Lambourne. My family members, some of my friends and stuff. People's houses have been kicked in, doors have been kicked. About nine raids in one house, in one village. It's a little village called Lambourne, a little sleepy village, which is not so sleepy. It's a very, very interesting place. Anyway, yeah, so I was taken up to, I believe it was Oxford. I say Oxford, but it was in the Oxfordshire border. I can't remember. Bearing in mind, I was smoking crack that day as well, so I was a little bit off kilter anyway. So I remember having cocaine in my pouch, in my trousers. I used to keep it in my sort of, with my waistband. And I kicked some stuff out the bottom of my shoes when I got out of the car to kick it under the car. I tried to remove as much as I could, thinking they haven't got nothing on me. They can't. If they arrest me, I've got nothing on me. They can't prove anything. Anyway, long story short, got to the police station, sat me in the cell. And about 2 hours later, they brought me into the interview room, and the police officer opposite. They do their usual thing, you know, they read all the acts, they press the tape and all that stuff. And he pulls out Exhibition A, which is a plastic see-through bag. It's my crack pipe. And it was a little Jack Daniels, you know, the little sort of the mini miniature Jack Daniels bottles. And I'd managed to tap through it and made a crack pipe out of it. And it was my special little crack pipe. If anyone does drugs or anything knows about drugs, you have kind of like pipes and things that you use, like maybe you use certain things for heroin, like tubes. And they're kind of personal to you. They're kind of like an extension of you. And the little Jack Daniels bottle was the Jack Daniels what I used to drink. So it was kind of like a representation of alcohol and crack. And it was kind of my little thing. Anyway, he picks his bag up. He says, you recognise this? I said, yeah, it's mine. And he said, anything to say? I said, yeah, you can keep it. He said, what? I said, oh, actually, no. I said, actually, can I have it? I started laughing. He goes, well, you know I can't. I said, no, you can keep it. He said, really? I said, yeah. I said, you just saved my life. He said, what do you mean? I said, I was either going to die by doing crack or get arrested. And I said, you guys have saved me now. I said, now you've given me a reason to stop. And he was obviously baffled by this. He was like, well, why don't you just stop? I said, because I'm too deep. I said, I'm far too gone. I said, I need someone to help me. And I said, even though you think what you're doing is obviously the right thing, you're arresting me. I said, you're actually helping me out. I said, because I'm too far. I'm too far gone and I really need help. So he was like, he's sort of puzzled. And I said to him, look, I said, the best thing you've done today is actually saved my life. And I said, but you guys don't even realise it. I said, I was just gone. I was completely gone. I didn't care about anything at all. I wanted to be dead. But then that would have been, you know, I always put it onto the child abuse, the sex abuse. That was the big thing that I was burying. I never wanted to face that. If I was ever sober, those were the things that would come round in my head. It was always that would bubble up. If I ever spent a couple of days sober without drinking or without doing something, those were the thoughts that would come back. So it was always something eating away at me, constantly eating away at me. So I pushed it away all those years. So that was my fuel to do all the drinking drugs, was to keep away from those memories, that trauma.
It's just an escape, really.
Yeah, yeah. It was numbing the pain. I mean, no, I'm sure there's other cofactors in there as well, but that was the turning point.
Okay, so you went to court, I imagine. How long did you do time?
I went to magistrates court, and they bumped it up to Crown Court because they couldn't deal with me. They found 1,001 ecstasy tablets. At the time, I was buying and selling cars, so my self-employed business front was buying and selling secondhand cars, and I would stash drugs in these cars. So what they found was scales, they found bags, they found all the stuff preparing them. But to be fair at the time there was a by this time I'd made two massive contacts, one up in Liverpool and one up in Leeds. So during the cocaine days, like the sort of the end of my thing, I'd made contacts in some large towns. Two main towns are close to where I is, and they had already working with some guys up north. So the entry or the sort of qualification to meet these people was you had to share knowledge about your family, about where you lived and stuff. It was kind of like you see in the films with Pablo Escobar, like, you know, you got to give me photographs of your daughters and your children and your wife and tell me your address. And you sort of to get qualified, they have to trust you because they don't know you from nothing. So you give information, they research that information, and they say, yeah, we can work with you now. And I was working with two very big suppliers. They weren't just drug dealers. These guys were, they were criminals. They were professional criminals. These were, you know, career criminals. I was what I thought a big fish in my little area. These guys were sharks. Okay, I was under no false impression.
What was their relationship with the police? They must have felt fairly untouchable.
I never spoke to them on much of a more of a business basis. No. Met them once or twice. I mean, one of the things when I was over in a town in Wiltshire, three other guys, one girl and two other guys that I was really good friends with. The reason why we're good friends because we used to buy everything with cash. Most people would tick. They would borrow the drugs and then sell it for other people. We were different. There were four of us. We had independent businesses. We run different areas, but we were good friends. We go out drinking together on the weekends and stuff. And we made a contact from Liverpool area. And these guys had come down, and we were buying the first 9-bar of coke. And the only thing I can describe it. It shimmered blue. It was like a shiny blue, white block. And we were like, yeah. And it was £25,000 for this block. It was cheap at the time. And the guy was like, right, he said, you got to cut this four times. You have to stamp on this or cut it four times. And we were looking at each other thinking, we didn't even know how to cut coke. We haven't got the machine. We haven't got the factory, the devices for this. He explained how to do it. And he said, you need a press. You need to press this thing. So out the bag came a press. And we're like, fucking hell. And he goes, that's £5,000 for the press. And we're like, but we don't want the press. And he pulled out a gun, put it on the table. And we just looked at each other and went, oh, shit. And we realised that was one of the points. We realised that we were no longer our own businessmen. We were in a closed little environment now, and we were theirs. We weren't ours. So I knew at that point, many years before, that every decision I made had to be my own decision, and my family and anyone connected to me was nothing to do with that. So if I was to ever be caught or imprisoned or taken to court, if I ever spoke names of these sort of people or spoke sort of any intricate details, the stuff that I knew that it wasn't going to affect just me. It was going to affect immediate people and probably people closer to those people as well. So I went in fully aware of what I was doing, and I went in with the full knowledge that I was going to take the full hit. And if anything happened, I was the one going to prison. I was the one taking the punishment. No one else needed to be dealt with. No one else needed to be spoken about. It was as simple as that. And I knew that many years before. So when I got arrested going forward, it went to the magistrate's court and they said, have you got anything to say? I said, nothing. So they took me to Crown Court, got given my barrister and all that stuff. And they basically gave me the sort of the lowdown. I'm looking at 5 to 8 years with the amount of drugs that were found. And I said, that's fine. That's cool. I'm good. So I signed myself into a rehab program called Turning Point.
Just before we get onto that, can you just give us your idea of your perception of anything that was going on at the higher levels of drug dealing? Because, I mean, for many people, you've already suggested that some police are turning a blind eye to this deliberately for whatever reason, maybe even being paid off, etc. Mm. But I think at a national level, an international level, this seems to be the only way to stop supplies of these powerful drugs, and that seems to be something which is just simply not dealt with. I mean, we had here in Bristol, for example, a few years ago, an operation by Avon and Somerset Police to arrest a whole load of homeless drug dealers and send them to prison. And then you think to yourself, well, of course, this is an idiotic thing to do because there'll just be a whole new tranche of homeless drug dealers will appear to take their place. And then they can sort of, the big guys can play one lot up against another lot. What I'm interested in is your perception of the international levels of trade.
Yeah, this for me, from what I know, from what I'm experienced, I know this goes right up through the police stations, up to the what you call lieutenants, colonels, generals. There's knowledge of this. There's knowledge of these things going on. And there are probably no more than a handful of people that are privy to the information.
So this is the military also, military intelligence?
Well, no, I'm talking that police. The police stations have their kind of... I'm using words like Lieutenant
Well, there's things like the National Crime Agency, and there are supposedly... They are supposedly dealing with organised crime, you know, supposedly.
Well, from what I know about shipments coming in and how things get into the country, there would have to be a knowledge within large establishments, government-based establishments, or back then government-funded establishments, or government arm, or things that were connected to the government's funding, things that obviously the taxpayers pay for. So back then, there was definite knowledge because all class levels, the talking politicians, corporate owners, corporation owners, they do drugs. Let's not pretend they don't. They're human beings. They like to party. They like to have orgies and sex and all the things.
Apparently banksters do. City was quite rife.
Oh, yeah, cocaine. These kind of things, they happen at all levels because it's human beings. We're all human beings and we all have likes and dislikes.
They're all buyable, I suppose.
Yeah, they're malleable. People like politicians, the conclusion I have of the majority of politicians that we sort of know of, they're malleable and they're just prostitutes.
And what about this whole thing of decriminalisation of drugs?
To be fair, I would probably lean more towards that in some way, primarily because it takes the criminality out of it. When you take the criminality out, it takes out the sort of the darker element of drugs, the secrecy. People being drug addicts, they're ill, and they're ill because probably they've got injuries, mental, psychological, physical injuries from the past.
Earl Jesse there, a unique personal story, I think you'll agree. Or if you found Earl's story interesting, you can hear an uncut version, which is much longer, an hour and three quarters of this interview, and that you can find on Radio 4All, which is our international server. That you can find at radio4all.net. That's www.radio4all.net. And search there for Earl Jesse, EARLJESSE. Yes, so not for children or for the faint-hearted.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Alan Brown, and I do economics.
Well, just what way are you qualified to talk about
economics? Well, I've just got a bachelor's in economics. My interest in economics essentially comes from, if you want to understand anything, follow the money. So it comes from that.
Well, look, what about the prorogation of Parliament? Because there is all sorts of legal challenges to it, as well as the Queen having signed it. Now, is the Queen going to be put in jail? Is it the right thing to do to prorogue Parliament? And has it been done for too long, too short? There's a big arguing over it. There never normally is.
Well, obviously, this is opinion, but I think it was the right thing to do, because essentially been 3 years of trying to sabotage by fair means and foul the results of the referendum. So as they haven't sorted out and tried to deliver any kind of Brexit in those 3 years, and they've continually voted down what was a truly awful Theresa May deal.
Do you think it was deliberately awful? Some people have said that.
I think probably what happened was that the EU got above itself. And essentially, it's been used to rolling over referendums in France and Ireland twice and Holland and getting its own way. So they thought they could get away with essentially pushing this very punishing Brexit, and that they would just roll over and it won't happen, if you know what I mean, a second referendum and backtrack. I think they miscalculated.
So what about the Corbyn position and the Labour Party? Because they've started off in 2017 saying, well, we want to implement Brexit. Actually, what's happening is they are now starting to campaign for a second referendum and with the Remain position.
Well, there's a problem in this position, that the manifesto was to respect the referendum and Labour increased its vote. Now we've got this kind of fairly absurd position from Emily Thornberry, that Labour would renegotiate a deal with the EU that they don't define what it is, that the EU say they won't give, because they're saying essentially Theresa May's deal or nothing. And then Labour would then have a referendum which they would campaign against their own deal, which is a kind of absurd position.
The other thing, of course, is since the first referendum hasn't been honoured, has not been delivered, the instruction given by the people, why is a second referendum more likely to?
Well, I mean, there doesn't seem to be much movement. So I don't see why there should be another referendum, as the facts haven't necessarily changed and people haven't moved their position. So the honourable way would be to have a Brexit and then campaign, if people wanted to rejoin, to rejoin. That would be a reasonable approach.
What about the seats? Which target seats have Labour got?
Well, this is the other problem, is because the Remain vote, although it's going to 52, 48 or whatever, was unevenly distributed, and the Remain was concentrated in England, in London, and outside England, in Scotland and Northern Ireland. This means that the vast majority of Labour target seats voted Leave. So Labour can't win solely on Remain, especially as it's fighting many other Remain parties, like the SNP, like Plaid Cymru, like the Greens, like the Lib Dems. They can't possibly hope to put together a majority.
So, I mean, since most Labour target seats voted to leave, surely the logical thing would be for the Labour position to be to leave if they wanted to win those seats.
Yes, I mean, you could have a more nuanced position that could still work. I mean, for instance, the 2017 manifesto was to respect the referendum, although Labour did campaign to stay. I mean, that wouldn't be as bad as Emily Thornberry's position, which is kind of absurd.
So Emily Thornberry is the shadow foreign secretary.
Yes.
Just remind us again, what is she saying? Because it doesn't seem to make sense to say that we will have a negotiation and then she's saying she will carry on campaigning to remain. So what's the point of having a deal if you're just going to ignore it and campaign to remain anyway?
Yes, I mean, and there's also the other problem is that we've had various votes in Parliament about a second referendum, and these have all been voted down. There is no majority in Parliament for revoking Article 50, which the UK could do unilaterally, or having a second referendum.
Okay, because this is important, isn't it? This is EU law here, and Article 50 has been triggered, so there's not a lot Parliament can do about that, is there?
Well, this is the quandary they're put in. They can't stop Article 50 because it's EU law, which is superior to UK law. So the only thing they can do is continually ask for extensions that the EU has to approve, all 27 have to approve, or they could unilaterally revoke. But the problem is there come a point where maybe Boris Johnson just wants to filibuster in the European Council, and then maybe France would say, no, we've had enough.
What about state aid? Because this is an enormous problem for any government that wants to intervene to save its own industries, is the EU state aid rules. How does that fit in with the deal?
Well, essentially, variations of the Theresa May deal are that up to 4 years after we leave and leave the bridging agreement, the EU can impose new state aid rules on the UK without consulting it, including investor-state dispute mechanism that's contained in the CETA-CUNDA agreement.
So this is really where a court rules that the government has to award a particular contract to a multinational corporation that's bid for it.
Yes. I mean, the EU is provisionally carried out CETA partially, even though it's not been ratified by all its members, shorn of the investor state dispute mechanism, but it will enter into law as soon as all EU countries have ratified CETA.
And that will take effect even if we have withdrawn from the EU.
Yes.
Why is that?
Because it's written into the Theresa May EU withdrawal agreement, bridge agreement.
What do you think is going to happen on the 31st of October?
My guess would be that there will be some kind of fudging of Theresa May's deal with maybe Northern Ireland only being in the backstop and not all the UK. I think that.
So what would that actually mean?
That would mean essentially that Northern Ireland will be part of a customs union and single market with the rest of the EU.
How long for?
And this is the problem, Theresa May's deal, until the EU agree to let us out.
But I mean, isn't this just a way of allowing the Irish Republic to take over Northern Ireland, you know, a united Ireland? I mean, that might be a good thing, but that's certainly not what was voted for in 2016.
No, I mean, I think the problem is that if Northern Ireland wants to do that's fine, but the problem is it applies to all the rest of the UK who voted to leave.
I mean, it would seem to me the only thing to do in that sort of situation would be to allow the Northern Irish their own little referendum on that specific backstop deal.
Yes.
What's going to be the economic implications of all of this, Alan? I mean, you say follow the money. What's going to happen if we do leave the EU without a deal or with this deal?
There are a lot of moving parts. I think it's almost very difficult to work out what's going to happen after October the 31st.
Can Britain survive economically without being part of the EU?
I think so. I think the main advantage is we're not part of the euro. I mean, they've kind of hobbled the very southern periphery. So I think there will be a rejig and there will be obviously an economic hit in the short term when these kind of trade is kind of reconfigured.
Okay, so some have also said that actually within the EU, Britain has been deindustrialised, that we've lost a lot of our, you know, the Labour Party has almost lost its reason to be there because you don't have the industries that we used to have before we joined the common market.
I wouldn't say this was particularly the fault of the EU, but the problem is that with Tory and new Labour policies, the EU and the single market have allowed the UK to specialise much more.
So, I mean, how come France and Germany have done so well that their economies are, and their industries have grown, whereas Britain has shrunk?
Well, France has got its own problems. I mean, it's essentially we had our own problems with, you know, Thatcher and kind of using interest rates to specialise in services and to crush wages by deindustrialisation. So this, but France is not as far down that line.
Okay, well, whereabouts is a good place, do you think, to pick up info online about this? Because we're not getting very good reports. I mean, I don't think we're getting very good analysis by the mass media, you know, the sort of BBC, ITV, the rest of them. Where's a good place to go to get some good stuff?
I would recommend Eurointelligence by Wolfgang Manchu. He's the FT's Europe correspondent. He's a Remainer, but he's critical. So, yeah.
Okay, Alan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Suggest interviewees, subscribe to our email list, and listen the week before broadcast if you like at our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, that is Earl Jesse and Alan Brown, and also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. If you have some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
Standing right.